Okay, just a few reminders before we get started today. My name is Molly Marin. I'm with the New York State Technical Assistance Center. And if you're new to the webinars, just know that our PowerPoint is available on our website, nysrti.org. That's for today's webinar is available. And then the recording for today's webinar will be available probably later this evening or definitely by tomorrow morning. We're very excited. Dr. Peisner-Feinberg will be live tweeting during today's webinar, so if you want to follow along or post comments, you can do that. I posted a message in the chat, but you can follow her at Ellen P. Feinberg on Twitter. And it's very exciting. We've been doing that the last few webinars. A couple other things. At the end of the webinar, I will post a link to the evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we do very much appreciate your feedback. Last week in the evaluation, a few folks noted that they had some technical issues. I just want to suggest if you are experiencing any technical issues, primarily with things not showing up, you most likely are using Internet Explorer, and I would recommend trying a different browser. We have seen a couple people have issues with Internet Explorer, so try using Google Chrome or Firefox. And I would completely get out of the first window and then open up a new browser and try it so you don't have any audio issues either. Any questions, you can text or you can chat with me in the chat box during the webinar. So without further ado, we're very excited. This is the last webinar in our pre-K series, Recognition and Response, RTI Goes to Pre-K. And we have with us Dr. Virginia Bisey and Dr. Ellen Peisner-Feinberg. They are senior scientists at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They co-direct a program of research on recognition and response, a model of tiered instruction linked to formative assessment that was developed and is being validated with funding from the Institute for Education Sciences at the U.S. Department of Education. Doctors Bisey and Peisner-Feinberg and their team have conducted several studies to evaluate the effects of R&R on children's language and literacy skills. In a more recent study, they also developed and evaluated an adaptation of this model for addressing the language and literacy skills of Latino dual language learners. With funding from the U.S. Department of Education, they are currently working on an application of the model to improve early mathematics instruction for all children and to create targeted interventions for some children who need additional instructional supports. In 2013, they co-edited the Handbook of Response to Intervention in Early Childhood, published by Paul H. Brooks Publishing, and arguably the most comprehensive source of information available on this topic. Today, they will present planning for implementation of R&R, and we are very excited to have them with us. If you have any questions during or at the end of the webinar, please post those in the chat, and at this time, I'm very pleased to introduce our guest presenters and turn it over to them. Welcome.
Thank you, Molly, and welcome to all of our participants today. This is our last webinar in the series on recognition and response, and we know this is a really busy time of year, and so we're very grateful that you were able to join us today. I will just add, in terms of trying to maximize your webinar experience, I have found that listening on the phone, the audio is much better than trying to listen over the internet. And I know that some of you have had some challenges with the audio portion, and we're very sorry about that. But I'll just share that tip with you. I recently participated on a webinar and found that I had the same experience many of you did. It was very challenging to have a smooth audio experience on the internet. Well, let's get started. We're going to be talking about the very last topic related to recognition response, which is how do you begin planning for implementation? So the goals for this webinar today are to, first of all, consider how strategic planning is used to support implementation. Secondly, we will talk about some of the key decisions that will need to be made prior to adopting and implementing this approach in a particular program or classroom. And finally, we'll talk about the resources and infrastructure supports that are necessary to implement R&R. And we did get a few questions that I will try to address at the end of this presentation, but certainly if you have a question that pops into your mind as you're listening, feel free to put that in the chat box and we will see that and respond accordingly. So implementation, what are the key issues? It's important to acknowledge that the use of RTI with children prior to kindergarten is still an emerging practice. The results of one survey of state administrators from 46 states showed that only two states reported that RTI was being implemented fully in pre-K, and only a few states reported having explicit statewide policies addressing the use of RTI in pre-K, and New York is one of those, I'm happy to say. So that was a survey that was published by Linus, Carta, and Greenwood, if you're interested, in 2010. So although RTI holds promise for supporting learning and development prior to kindergarten, we have very little experience implementing it in our field, and additional research is needed to provide direct evidence of the efficacy of this approach with younger children and to guide its implementation. And I think it's important to acknowledge that before we say anything else today. And we addressed this issue early on when we were sharing some of the foundational concepts related to RTI more broadly, and we pointed out that there is research, there's a growing body of research showing that it is effective for addressing reading and math skills in K-12, but we have very little direct evidence of that effectiveness in pre-K. So we just want to make sure that we reinforce that notion, and because it helps us understand the need for further research in that area. Also, there are no specific provisions within federal legislation, something we also addressed early on in the series, nor are there policies or specific guidelines addressing the use of RTI prior to kindergarten. And because of this, the field faces a number of significant implementation challenges, because we just, in the absence of these policies and specific guidelines, there is a lot of confusion about what we mean by RTI, and what is necessary to implement it effectively. I think one of the most significant challenges that the field faces currently is the lack of consensus on what RTI means. Charles Greenwood and his colleagues identified a number of myths regarding RTI in early childhood, including that RTI is intended to replace special education, and that it necessarily delays referral and eligibility for special education services, neither of which are true. But those are myths that sometimes that it gets shared, and those misperceptions are unfortunate and I think sometimes damage the idea of RTI in early childhood. So in the absence of both research knowledge and consensus wisdom on RTI and specific policies, we sometimes have publications that come out on this topic, but these publications have also contributed to the confusion by sometimes disseminating information that is inconsistent with an RTI approach. And so in the literature, if you look for information on RTI, you might find some articles in which there are models or examples of RTI in early childhood that are poor exemplars of this approach. So, for example, they might share a model in which an outcome measure is confused with a formative assessment measure, or give an example of that includes only a Tier 1 instructional component. And so that would not be a good exemplar of a tiered model in early childhood. So, we have a lot of challenges, and we are lacking both research as well as experience in implementing this, as well as professional standards, guidelines, consensus statements that define RTI and broadly describe its use in pre-K. And we mentioned, I think, in the first overview webinar that another problem in this regard is that we don't have agreed upon terminology related to RTI, and so we shared with you some of the many terms that are being used, sometimes incorrectly, to refer to RTI, and those include things like tiered approaches, early intervening and early intervention, instruction and intervention, learning difficulties versus learning disabilities, what the meaning of formative assessment versus screening, and progress monitoring, the meanings of terms like curriculum-based measures. So if you're, you know, that's part of the confusion is that we don't have agreement and clear definitions for these terms. If you want more information about terminology, we discussed that in the first webinar, and you can find that archived on the website. Another challenge I think that we face that is unique to the early childhood field is determining how RTI will work with within existing contexts, including the very fragmented early childhood system in which we have multiple programs and initiatives, funding streams, eligibility criteria, program standards, and quality and accountability frameworks. So if you get outside of the school system, there are a patchwork of different types of programs, all of which have their own standards, their own determinations for how children receive services and so forth. And I think all of that contributes to the confusion for how do we begin thinking about implementing RTI in early childhood. I think with respect to RTI, this problem is compounded by the pressing need for systemic supports for implementation. We're talking about adoption at the program level versus the classroom level, coordination between general and special education, and integration within existing program practices. And so that's a very challenging context, and it's going to take a lot of time and resources for us to figure out exactly how we're going to implement in that particular context and the kinds of infrastructure supports that will be needed for RTI to work effectively. I think an important issue that the early childhood field in particular must resolve is determining family involvement in the absence of procedural safeguards within RTI. Methods of sharing information with families from diverse backgrounds and opportunities for families to participate in database decision-making in collaboration with early childhood program staff. These are issues that we have not worked out yet as a field and present challenges to programs, districts, states that are interested in adopting recognition and response or a tiered approach. And then finally, a very significant challenge to implementing RTI in our field concerns the lack of resources that are currently available to support this approach. In the context of school-age RTI, as we have talked about before, there are many, many more resources available to support implementation, both with respect to formative assessment, technology-based assessment tools such as AIMSWeb and the DIBLs and so forth, and a range of validated intervention protocols and small group lessons that are available for use within RTI. We do have some resources for implementing RTI in early childhood, and we'll be talking about those later, but I'll just mention a couple of them. One is there is a center, the Center for RTI in Early Childhood, called Critique sometimes for short, but again, it's CRTIEC, and that stands for the Center for RTI in Early Childhood. That was funded by the U.S. Department of Education and primarily was funded for the research team to conduct additional studies that focused on formative assessments linked to research-based interventions in the area of language and literacy. So you can go there to find out more about what was developed through research and what is currently available. You can also turn to some of the models of RTI in early childhood that we have referenced earlier and just check out resources available from the developers, typically on their websites, and that's available on the Pyramid Models website, the CCEFL website, and then Recognition Response also has a website with resources available. So those are just a couple of resources that I wanted to mention right off the bat. Okay, so with all of those challenges, you know, we can say that RTI is still promising and that there is a rainbow, and there's a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow, we think, but it's going to take a concerted effort in the field for us to get there. The other point I wanted to make is that practice can't wait, and teachers can't wait. Children can't wait. And so what we're seeing is even before we have all of the research evidence that we need, even before we have all of the policies that we need, even before we have all of the guidance that we need, we're seeing that in early childhood programs, we're seeing that some components of a tiered approach are being adopted and implemented in early childhood classrooms. And so we're seeing elements such as formative assessments happening. Sometimes those formative assessments aren't linked to targeted interventions for some children, but we're seeing that at least on the formative assessment side, some movement, some attempt to begin implementing this approach. We're seeing more usage of small group instruction. Another indication that the field isn't waiting until we get this all figured out. They are moving in the direction of adopting some of these components. And just a reminder, we are talking about the recognition response model specifically in all of our webinar presentations that begins with a Tier 1 foundation focused on addressing the instructional needs of all children, which includes having a comprehensive core curriculum and intentional teaching of that curriculum and some method of formative assessment for all children at regular intervals throughout the year. And then on top of that, we're talking about having Tier 2 interventions for some children who need them. And those children are determined on the basis of formative assessment so that teachers don't have to intuit which children might need additional instructional supports. They're actually using data from their own assessments that they have conducted to determine that. And these children get explicit small group interventions augmented by embedded learning activities. Formative assessment continues to happen here so that we can monitor the progress of these children and determine if adjustments are needed. And then finally, Tier 3, for a few children who demonstrate or show us that they needed even more intensive individualized support on the basis of formative assessment. We know that. And so these are the scaffolding strategies that teachers use primarily at Tier 2 in the small group lessons, but those can also be used throughout the day throughout the curriculum at Tier 1, consisting of modeling and peer support and prompting and so forth. So we talked about that in one of our earlier webinars. And then surrounding this entire system is something that we think is critical to implementing this approach, which is the collaborative problem-solving process. And later in this presentation, I'm going to share with you a video example of just a little snippet of one meeting, one collaborative problem-solving team meeting, so you can get a sense of the kinds of conversations that happen in those places and the supports that teachers offer one another when they are implementing a new intervention together. So we'll say a little bit more about that later. Okay, so let's move to thinking about the steps that are necessary in planning for adoption of recognition response. And I think this would apply to adoption of any tiered instructional model. So we start with a series of questions, and we have basically used these questions with other school districts that have decided that they wanted to move in the direction of adopting recognition response. And these are the kinds of questions that we have assisted those school systems in addressing as they have moved forward in the planning process. First of all, we start with which programs and people should be involved. And I think that seems like a fairly straightforward question, but it's very important because Sometimes there's a determination that only a certain type of program will be involved, at least initially in the first phase, and that will determine which people would be involved as well. To what extent will families be involved? To what extent will various specialists who interact with early childhood teachers and other staff be involved? And so that's a very important question. Another key question in planning for adoption is, where will RTI be introduced? And it's related to that first question. So, for example, if the decision is made that, that it will only be introduced in blended Head Start classrooms, classrooms in which Head Start is blended with another type of early childhood program, I think that will be important to notice and to acknowledge in terms of figuring out which people will be involved in planning for implementation. If RTI or R&R will only be implemented in primarily in special education classrooms or in inclusive programs, again, that decision will have an impact on who will be involved. A third important question is, how will decisions be made? Will these be made by an administrator? Will the decisions be through some kind of consensus process? Will there actually be voting? So it's important up front to figure out how decisions will be made. If you bring a group of people together and you engage them in strategic planning, then there needs to be some consideration given to decision making and how those decisions will be made, what processes will be used, and so forth. And then there will be information that will need to be communicated to someone, and how will that get communicated? As decisions are being made, there will be records of those decisions, and that will need to be shared with people at the meeting, people who are not involved in this planning structure. Information will need to be shared with families, perhaps. And so some consideration should be given to what form the communication should take and for which audiences the communications are intended. And then finally, what is the context for implementing a tiered approach in early childhood programs in classrooms? Is the context, are these classrooms that are inclusive, for example? Are these classrooms serving both children with and without disabilities? Are there other children eligible for other types of services being served in these classrooms? What's mandated by the school district in terms of instructional time? What curriculum is being used? So it's all the contextual aspects of this, and all of these are important to think about and to take note of. One question that we often get as we talk to people around the country is, and this often comes from individual teachers, is how can I as a pre-K teacher begin using this approach in my classroom? And our answer is always, you as an individual teacher really can't implement this on your own. You really need to be part of a bigger context. These decisions are often made at a program level or a district level. Occasionally, as it relates to K-12, at a state level. And so you as an individual teacher can't really make a decision to implement this on your own because it involves decisions related to curriculum instruction that you just aren't going to be able to make on your own. So that would be our answer, but you could certainly work to try to convince people in your system or program that this might be an important idea to explore together. One recommendation we would have in response to all of these questions that I just posed under planning for adoption is that it's very important to ensure administrative buy-in, support, and leadership. Often when we are approached by a school district to assist in planning for implementation of recognition response, we're approached by a school administrator. And it's often an early childhood administrator, sometimes someone in the superintendent's office. But it's always, the contact usually comes from an administrator of some sort. And that's really important because that person has the authority and the responsibility for leading an initiative such as this. So our recommendation is to be sure that you've got that level of support and buy-in before going forward. Another recommendation in response to planning for adoption is to create a strategic planning structure and process. And that goes back to the question of which programs and people should be involved and how do you make decisions. You really need to figure out a structure for how you're going to plan. Often in the K-12 arena, it can take up to a year or more to plan for implementation. And so in early childhood, we're often, we're not that patient. We want to just, as soon as we get the idea, we want to move forward. But we highly recommend, a considerable length of time for planning so that implementation will be successful. And it's helpful to keep in mind how long this actually takes in the public school arena so that we can actually anticipate that it should take some time and that these decisions can't be made overnight and these structures can't be put into place overnight. So we need a group of people who will be involved. We need some kind of regular planning meetings or opportunities to collaborate, work together, a context for making decisions, and a way of documenting those and putting those decisions into practice. Okay, so in addition to planning for adoption, I had mentioned earlier that there are a number of decisions that are going to have to be made related to implementation. And if you've got your planning structure in place and your process, then you are really set up well to begin to make these decisions. These are the kinds of discussions and decisions that will have to happen in order to sort of have a fully developed plan for implementation. The first key decision is what assessment tools and methods will be used for formative assessment. Okay? And we had an entire presentation on the topic of assessment, so you can go back and review that if you're interested. But essentially, I would recommend that you do that so that as you're thinking about making that decision of choosing an assessment tool or method or deciding that you've already got one that's working well that could be used, that you go back and make sure that it aligns with all of the recommendations we gave for the properties that a formative assessment tool should have in the context of RTI in early childhood. The second big decision is what curriculum will be used for small group instruction at Tier 2. And this is important because after going through the process of assessing all the children, making decisions about which children need additional supports, instructional supports, we want to make sure that those children are exposed to the most effective, the most research-based instruction so that we're not wasting their time, we're not wasting the teacher's time, and that we're making, the most use of small group instruction. So I'll say more about that in just a minute. And then the third big decision is how will collaborative problem solving be organized? And that's a huge challenge for us in early childhood because we don't have these teams set up already. We have to think about how to create them, and we have to be creative in how we do that because different early childhood programs have access to different specialists, families, administrators, and so forth. And so we really have to think creatively about how to do that. I'll say more about that in a minute, too. So I have some recommendations to think about here in terms of responding to this step two, making decisions. The first is to consider what curricula, interventions, and assessments are already in place. Okay? So this is really important because, the whole notion of a tiered instructional approach is that we are building on enhancing what's already in place. And we can't do that unless we have a good understanding of what's already being used. So we sort of have to stand back and take an inventory. And it's pretty interesting when we do this. Sometimes we find out that that different curricula are being used, certainly across different school districts and systems. We find many different curricula being used. Interventions, it's more difficult to get a handle on that. Many of these interventions are research-based interventions that come out of special education primarily, and they may have, you know, branded names, but they often aren't associated with commercially available tools and so forth. So sometimes people are aware of them, but sometimes not, so there's some variability there. And then assessments, we find that there are many, many assessments, oftentimes a number of assessments in one program or one classroom that are already being used. But as we had mentioned before in our assessment presentation, sometimes those assessments are not being used as efficiently or as effectively as they could be to really inform decision-making. Our recommendation is to stand back, take an inventory, and ideally do this as a team, as part of your strategic planning process, to really take a look across your entire system, across the different kinds of programs, to really consider what are the resources that are already there and that you'll want to continue using. What are your foundational curricula that are being used? What interventions have been introduced and are being used effectively? And again, what's in place in terms of assessment? One of the tools that we often hear about in terms of assessment is teaching strategies, GOLD, and that, of course, is the curriculum-based assessment that is being used in conjunction with the creative curriculum. And we think that that is a tool that does help inform teachers in terms of whether or not children are addressing their curriculum goals. It is, in our opinion, is not an adequate formative assessment tool for use within recognition and response or within RTI in early childhood. So that's the kind of assessment and the kind of discussions I think that a team would have, is looking at what they're using, what they're being used for, and deciding whether or not what is already being used is adequate for the purpose of an RTI approach. The same thing is true with respect to curricula. We often hear that creative curriculum is being used, or high scope, or the OWL curriculum, or a number of others. And again, you know, having something in place as a foundational curriculum is an important starting point, but by now I hope you would agree with us that that one curriculum, no matter how good it is, no matter how research-based it is, no matter how good the teacher is, that one curriculum will probably not meet the needs of every single child in any particular classroom. But it's important to know where you're starting from. Another recommendation with respect to making decisions is to determine what aspects of learning and development will be the focus of an R&R approach. And we would recommend that you start with one focus area. So, and that could be language and literacy. That's where we started in our research. We have now made a pivot to focusing on mathematics instruction. And then outside of R&R, social emotional development and challenging behaviors could be yet another focus of a tiered approach. But within R&R, we focus primarily on learning, as opposed to social emotional development. So we would suggest focusing on one or the other, either language and literacy or mathematics, but not trying to do both at the same time. Another recommendation with respect to the decisions that will need to be made in terms of the formative assessment and instructional components is to review the literature to find research-based curricula and instructional approaches for use for use at Tiers 1 and 2. Now, we know that you are teachers and administrators, and you're not going to be reviewing the literature and, you know, writing up your own review of the literature, and we're not recommending that. But we do think it's important to be in tune with what is available in terms of our research-based knowledge. And one very efficient way of doing that is by going to the What Works Clearinghouse, which is the official arm of the U.S. Department of Education, and they basically have, you know, they vet all of the research evidence, and they make decisions about which curricula, which interventions have sufficient evidence of effectiveness for pre-K, and of course for older children as well and younger children. So if you go there and you go to the Early Childhood Education page of the What Works Clearinghouse, and you can do a search and you can look at all of the curricula that have been reviewed by the U.S. Department of Education and the results of the review in terms of effectiveness ratings. Take a look at what curriculum you're using and see how it, how does it fare in terms of the What Works Clearinghouse evidence-based standards. It's important to know that. And I think it's important to see what other curricula could be used if you're going to be developing a tiered approach. You might be needing to adopt another one, and this is a good starting point. Another recommendation that we often make to school districts that are moving toward adoption and implementation of R&R is to start with determining if any adjustments are needed at Tier 1. And, of course, we start by thinking about very broadly. If you do take an inventory, you might find that there is a curriculum that is required by the program or the district, but that it's not being fully implemented. And this is quite common. What we find sometimes, the curricula are sitting on the shelf. They're not really being implemented. Certainly, if we find that there is no Tier 1 curriculum, that is something to take note of and would need to be addressed before moving forward. The other thing to take note of is the use of either too many or not enough assessments. And just, you know, making note if assessments are being used correctly, if they're being used for the purpose that they were designed to be used for, and making those kinds of adjustments, making sure, for example, that there are opportunities for children to learn language and literacy and math concepts throughout the day and throughout the curriculum, making sure that the learning centers present children with appropriately challenging opportunities to learn those concepts, and that those get changed regularly to address children's growing skill levels in those areas. And so those are the kinds of things we recommend people look at. You know, what's happening at Tier 1? What is the quality of the instruction in the program at Tier 1? And make those adjustments before trying to map onto this Tiers 2 and 3. Another recommendation is to select a research-based curriculum for use in Tier 2 small group lessons. We do not recommend that teachers create these lessons on their own. One of the principles of both RTI and recognition and response is the use of research-based curriculum, both at Tiers 1 and 2. So we need to have something that's research-based, that has an appropriate scope and sequence, sufficient repetition built in. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to select a curriculum at Tier 2. I think there are a couple of options for how to do that. One is to, as I suggested earlier, go back to the What Works Clearinghouse and do a review. Just scroll through all the curricula that are there. There aren't that many. It won't take you that long. But especially in the area of mathematics, you won't find that many. But in language and literacy, there are a number now, but not too many for you to actually review. And find one that could be used as a complementary curriculum to your Tier 1 core curriculum. So, for example, if you're using creative curriculum in your program or your classroom at Tier 1, and you're interested in a tiered approach to support and promote language and literacy skills in young children, then you'd be looking for a content-specific curriculum that could be used at Tier 2 that would complement what children are being taught at Tier 1. And, you know, so there are a number of those that can be used. We've tried several different ones in our research that have worked well for us. And as long as they're research-based and appropriate for this age group, I think there are several options. So that's one approach. The second option here would be if you had a curriculum at Tier 1 and you wanted to also use it at Tier 2, you could use the same curriculum for both Tiers 1 and 2, but you'd have to figure out what pieces of the curriculum would be used at tiers 1 and which pieces would be used at Tier 2. So, and we've tried this both ways. We're currently figuring out. We're using a core, a Tier 1 math curriculum as a foundational curriculum, but we're also specifying a part of it, a small group component that will be used at Tier 2 for our small group lessons. So those are two different approaches that you can think about. Another recommendation is to select an appropriate formative assessment tool and decide what criteria will be used to select target children at Tiers 2 and 3. And I think this is this recommendation, I think, makes it pretty clear why an individual teacher can't decide to implement recognition response or RTI on his or her own. These are very important decisions. They need to be made at the program or district level, and they need to have approval at that level as well. I think I've already mentioned how important it is to choose the right formative assessment tool, and there was an entire presentation on that. I believe too that we touched on the notion that we have to create some criteria for how we will select target children at the different tier levels. And so you can review the assessment presentation, but essentially the approaches involve using a local norms approach where we really just think about comparing children to their peers in the classroom and make decisions that perhaps the lowest 25th percentile will receive the tiered or the targeted interventions. That's one way to make a decision. Another is to use national norms and to compare children to a normed sample. Unfortunately, in early childhood, those don't exist yet for formative assessment tools. So although that's possible to use that approach in K-12, it's not yet possible in early childhood. Cut scores is another way where you basically determine a point at which a score where children below that score will be included as part of a target group of children. Again, that's not a well-developed approach in early childhood yet either, but hopefully in the future it will be. So for now, it's the local normed approach that we're relying on primarily. Another recommendation is to determine what is feasible to support teachers' implementation and database decision-making. I think the real focus here is to figure out how we can create some kind of a structure that promotes collaboration so that teachers are not having to make decisions in isolation. So we need some kind of a structure, and we can start with thinking about what's already in place in your program at the local level to support collaboration. Are there opportunities where teachers already come together to support one another, to have conversations and so forth? That maybe we could build upon that opportunity. We need to decide how families and other specialists will be involved in this. It's very sometimes difficult to involve families who are not available during the working day to be a part of these kinds of meetings and decision-making structures, but we need to find ways to involve them, particularly at critical junctures. For example, if we reach a point when we are deciding that children need tier 2 or tier 3 kinds of supports and making sure that we involve families sharing information with them, but also gathering information from them about their perspectives on their children's development and learning. One model that we have used effectively in our research, and it's just kind of the beginning of thinking about how to create these collaborative structures, is to think about bringing teachers together into what we call a community of practice kind of approach, sometimes called learning communities, but or professional learning communities. And we have found that to work very effectively in terms of especially teachers that have been, that are a part of an effort to implement something new. Bringing teachers together, you often get teachers who are experienced, teachers who are new, teachers who are in between, and a very nice collaboration happens when you sort of create the right conditions for teachers to support one another. So that's something that we have used effectively. We call it a community of practice, and that can morph into collaborative problem solving once teachers begin gathering formative assessments and using the data together to support one another and using the data to make decisions. I think another important decision will be determining the best way of providing ongoing supports for implementation. And this needs to be a little more individualized. So whereas the community of practice I just mentioned really focused on the collective or the collaborative, I think about this as how can we support individual teachers in their classrooms? And this involves someone with experience, who is trusted, coming in, who is able to observe, to provide some kind of corrective feedback sometimes, to offer support. And there are many different models for doing this, coaching, consultation, technical assistance, mentorship. Again, all of these approaches are nice ways of addressing the individualized needs of teachers as they go about the business of implementing recognition response or RTI in early childhood. It needs to be individualized because we find that teachers often fall along a continuum or a spectrum in terms of how easy or difficult it is for them to implement something new in their classrooms. Some teachers find it very easy. They catch on right away. They get their formative assessments done quickly on all of the children. They just catch on. They are just naturals in terms of working with those children in small groups and using the data to monitor progress. And then we have teachers who, it takes them much longer to understand how to administer the assessments to young children and to do it in a way that doesn't sort of spread it out over too many days or too many weeks. But we find that most teachers with adequate professional development, or I should say high-quality professional development and ongoing supports, are able to learn these new skills and are very good implementers of the intervention. We just often have one or two that struggle, but we try to individualize and support them as well. Okay. Finally, we're going to move to talking about getting right down to the actual planning for implementation, because we've now thought about, all of the decisions that we need to make. We have, created some kind of a structure for making those decisions and a process. So now we're just going to get right down to the nitty-gritty here in terms of thinking about the actual plan so that we're just ready to implement in the fall. If we think about this whole planning process as having been conducted over part of an academic year or a whole year, we are now moving toward implementation in the fall. So So the first thing we would recommend is to create an overall plan for implementation. And what I've tried to do here is just list what I think are some important elements of those plans, of that plan. And many of these things I've already touched on. So I won't say too much, but we'll just kind of touch on what we think should be a part of this implementation plan. The first is the assessments and curricular components that will be used within recognition response. And so, as we've talked about, you've got the structure, you've made the decision, and so the plan just needs to basically represent those decisions. What assessments will be used and what curricula will be used? The plan also should have a timeline so that teachers know exactly when they're supposed to conduct those formative assessments, you know, fall, winter, spring. But that's not enough information. It has to be more detailed than that. It has to specify an actual window of time when you're aiming for all of those assessments to be completed. Okay? So it would actually specify a time in the fall, one in the winter, and one in the spring for those. Okay? Same with the tiered interventions. When do the small group lessons start in the fall and when do they end? When do the small group lessons begin in the spring and when do they end? Okay? So the timeline should be very clear. We need some criteria for selecting target children and evaluating their progress, as I've already mentioned, and that should be very spelled out as part of this plan. We need written implementation guidelines. Okay, so it should just specify in as much detail as possible exactly what teachers are expected to do and when they're expected to do it. The plan should include checklists and forms to document assessment results and children's exposure to interventions. We have created a number of these forms and documents in our own research. They're very easy to create. But essentially, we need a sense of, for each small group lesson, which children actually were there, were present. Because if we find that there was a child who was only there half of the time, that could explain why the child was not very responsive to that intervention. So we need to get a sense of children's exposure to the intervention. And we also need to document our assessment results. In addition, we need, as part of the plan, we need a plan for providing professional development and ongoing supports. Who is going to do the professional development? When will that occur? What is the format for that? Is it web-based? Are teachers coming and will they be there in person? Will there be some kind of guided practice session and corrective feedback that occurs either, you know, during professional development or in the classroom? And how will the teacher be supported in an individualized way throughout implementation? So that's all part of that plan. In addition, we need a method to evaluate teacher proficiency in the assessment and instructional components. And I think that's important because if we find that a teacher really hasn't become proficient in administering an assessment, we're not ready to launch that teacher off to go forward and start gathering data on the children in her classroom, because I don't think the data will be very useful. So we want to make sure that there's some method of basically, you know, checking teachers off and making sure that they can do the assessment as it was designed to be given in a standardized fashion, and that they can do the instructional components. And sometimes that's just a simple observation or two. Watching a teacher during a small group lesson can give you a lot of information about whether or not they are following all of the steps in a lesson, or if they're skipping steps, if they're adding kind of their own ideas, or if they're really following the lesson as it was intended to be taught. Are they using the materials that go with the lesson and so forth? So these are the kinds of things we look for when we are basically ready to say, yes, this teacher is ready to go. We need, as I've mentioned a couple of times, we need a structure for collaborative problem solving and information sharing. And then finally, this is a luxury, but I think it would be important if programs have the resources to think about data that they can use to evaluate this intervention. An obvious source of data that they will have without gathering anything new is the formative assessment results that they'll have on all of the children. And you'll have that at 3 points throughout the school year, fall, winter, and spring. It would be recommended, it would be ideal if you could have additional assessments that are norm reference, but we realize that that could be challenging for most programs, but ideally it would be recommended to have some additional assessments so that you could look at children's learning and development pre and post introduction of the intervention. So, as promised, I want to share with you a short video clip, and this is an actual community of practice meeting. It's not one that we staged. These are real teachers in a real school district having a real conversation as they were beginning to implement this recognition response approach in their classroom. So let's listen in right now. Okay, so you now have seen an example of a community of practice meeting, and I think it gave you just a sense of the kinds of conversations that can occur in a context where people trust one another. They're not evaluating one another. The whole point is to share information and to collectively problem solve and to support one another. So it when it works well, it's really a very nice thing and very essential, I think, for supporting implementation of something that's new in a classroom. So we're going to kind of start to wind up now and review what we talked about. I think we looked at some issues related to implementation. We discussed strategies related to adoption and planning necessary to support implementation. We discussed some of the key decisions that will need to be made related to the assessment and instructional components, and we looked at an example of collaborative problem solving within R&R. I think one question that I have for all of you to think about, obviously you can't give me your answers, I regret, but you can think about and reflect upon this, is what will you do with the information that you have gained, not just today, but throughout the entire webinar series? I hope that it has helped you appreciate some of the very wonderful practice that's already in place in your program and in your classrooms, and I'm sure it is. And perhaps raise some questions for you about, you know, what you could be doing differently if you wanted to fully implement a tiered approach. I hope it's raised questions for you about what you might do next, who you might approach, what kinds of conversations you could have, what information you need to seek out so that you could actually move forward in thinking about how to realize the vision of recognition response or a tiered approach in your classroom. I'm sorry that I can't hear your answers, but I hope that you can reflect on what you will do. I hope each of you will find some way to use this information that will support your practice and move it forward. At this time, I'm going to just, these are some of the, just two references that if you want more information from the handbook. I want to, I think we have a little bit of time left. And so I'm going to share with you a couple of questions that we got. I don't see any questions in the chat box. That means I must have answered everybody's question, and there isn't a single question out there about implementation. So that means I did a really good job today. Now, Ellen is telling me that's not true. So I'm going to read a couple of questions that that I received. One is from an administrator who is interested in supporting a recognition and response approach in her programs, the ones that she oversees. And her question is, how do I get started? I love that question because it's coming from an administrator, and I think that administrator has the power to really actually begin being a change agent in her school district. And I would recommend that she think about a couple of things. One is, I bet there's an RTI coordinator in her school district who is in charge of RTI for K-5 or broader, or at least K-3, and that she thinks about meeting with that RTI coordinator and having a conversation, because I think that person could be a wealth of knowledge for her about how to get started. So I would recommend becoming that person's best friend and really partnering with that person. Another recommendation would be to start to research the different conceptual frameworks that exist in early childhood. Figure out which one you think would work best for what you want to accomplish. If you're more interested in social-emotional development, you probably want to take a look at the pyramid model. Second steps is another one that you might want to take a look at. If you're interested in academic learning and language, literacy, and math, we, of course, would recommend recognition and response, but we also don't know of another model out there right now that addresses academic learning. But I would recommend to get into the literature, to actually just Google these things and see what you can find out. And then my third recommendation would be to partner with a university team, researchers, experts in the field, who could really be good partners in this work with you. So those are a couple of ideas. There's another question that I got about where can I go for more information and resources. I've mentioned the Center for RTI and Early Childhood Critique. That's a good place to go. And again, pyramid model, recognition response, building blocks. Those are three models that have been operationalized for early childhood. And the Handbook of RTI and Early Childhood that Ellen and I co-edited is another good resource. I've got another question here. It says, my program already uses formative assessment, but teachers are expected to come up with their own individualized interventions. Where do I go from here? So this is a really good question, and I hope this teacher, if she's been listening in, has a few ideas about how we might respond to this. First of all, we don't think it's really the right approach or even fair to expect that teachers would come up with their own individualized interventions within a RTI kind of an approach. As we said, these need to be research-based. They need to be, from a structured curriculum, and it needs to have scope and sequence, a plan for how to teach children skills, one skill that builds on the next and so forth. And so teachers can't be expected to just do this on the fly. It just doesn't make sense. So my recommendation would be to work within your program, within your administrators to help them understand that it might be more effective to, as a school district or as a program, to work together to determine a curriculum that could be used, or a part of a Tier 1 curriculum that could be used as the basis of your small group lessons. And then finally, I've got a question from a teacher who says, I'm excited about using this approach. I heard about it at a conference. I'm not sure how to get started. And I think that all of you who've been listening in would know how to respond to this question. My response would be, unfortunately, this is not something that you can do on your own. You really need to figure out a way to do this as part of your program, a group of school personnel coming together, making a decision to adopt this approach, and then creating an implementation strategic planning team and moving forward in that direction. Hopefully this presentation has helped everyone understand that that is the best way to proceed. So I see another question that has popped up. What kind of funding may be necessary to begin this process? That's a good question, and I didn't talk about it at all. Within IDEA, there are funds that are available for schools for K-12 to think about using, a portion of their money for RTI. Unfortunately, pre-K was never mentioned in the provisions on RTI in the IDEA legislation. So there are no funding mechanisms through any kind of federal legislation that I know of. Sometimes states start with just thinking about this, not so much as needing new personnel or new services, but really thinking about it from the perspective of how can we make our existing early childhood programs and services of better quality? How can we raise the quality in those programs? And so this kind of approach, this looking at what you're doing and trying to enhance it by making sure you have appropriate formative assessments, by making sure you have comprehensive core curricula and perhaps complementary curricula that are research-based. These are all steps that could be put into place to improve the quality of an existing program. We're talking about teachers implementing this, not specialists, and so it does mean that teachers are going to have to get professional development, so you have the costs related to professional development, but teachers have to get professional development anyway, so this could be a matter of thinking about how to use your existing staff development days with regard to RTI or recognition response, as opposed to using them on a variety of topics. Maybe, there's you could think about devoting some of that time for this approach. In terms of supporting implementation in an ongoing way, this does require the use of coaching or mentors or somebody who can basically support teachers individually. But we're finding more and more that many of the larger school districts have some already have some kind of a coaching structure in place. And so, again, using your existing structures, but maybe changing the focus of what those coaches are doing. If you don't have a coaching structure, then I would highly recommend some kind of an opportunity for teachers to come together in a professional learning community context or a community of practice context so that they have opportunities to work together. You're going to need someone to lead that effort, and that needs to be someone knowledgeable both in RTI and in early childhood practice and early childhood curricula and assessment. But those are just, I don't have any magic formulas or answers regarding how you can get more funding, but I think what I'm trying to do is give you suggestions for thinking about how you can build on the structures you already have in place, the curricula and resources you already have in place, but redirecting them so that you could begin to move toward a tiered approach, but that will entail a lot of collaborative like processes and implementation planning and decision making. So, we have a question. Do you agree that RTI should be a 6 to 8 week program? We see it as unfolding throughout an entire school year. And so when we talk about it, it's got the formative assessment piece starts right up in September, October, November. Often that's the first small group lesson intervention window. Then we start up with in the winter we have assessments again, and then another 2 month window of small group intervention, and then we end with the third formative assessment point. So it's an entire school year. And the question is has popped up here, will we be able to contact you later to ask questions as we implement R&R or preschool programs? And I would say, sure. Yeah, we have, you can go to our website and there is a way that you can contact us there. We have a recognition response email that you can send your questions through that way. It has been a pleasure being a part of this, and I am going to wrap up now and just thank you for your participation today and throughout the series. I am trying to envision what each of you look like. Wish that we could at some point be in front of you and have a conversation, because that is truly the best way to learn from one another, not through a conference call, but we're doing the best we can. And I'm going to pass the phone to my colleague and let her add her thanks as well.
Yes, thank you all again for your participation in our webinar series. We hope that you have learned about all of the components about recognition and response, and that we not only have imparted information, but that we've imparted excitement about our model, and that you look forward to going back and at least discussing the ideas and hopefully getting started with implementing recognition and response. And I believe we're out of time, so this concludes our series, and good luck. Goodbye.